This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
17 days before the tragedy of September 11th, 2001, a chilling event unfolded in a tiny New Hampshire town. A pilot weaponized an airplane, intentionally crashing it into his own home. The attack made national news. Who was this pilot? Why would he do such a thing? Now, the pilot's wife is speaking out. Joe Fonda, who was married to him for 20 years, says their relationship was characterized by emotional and financial abuse, infidelity, and instability from the very beginning. Less than 48 hours before the plane crash, Joe obtained a restraining order against him and fled with their 8-year-old daughter. Joe's terrifying story is a powerful reminder of what lurks when toxic relationships end. In fact, 90% of survivors experience post-separation abuse, which can escalate quickly and violently, even if the perpetrator has never been violent before. Ending a relationship doesn't end the danger. From Red Table Talk Podcasts and iHeartMedia, I'm Dr. Romani, and this is Navigating Narcissism. This podcast should not be used as a substitute for medical or mental health advice. Individuals are advised to seek independent medical advice, counseling, and/or therapy from a healthcare professional with respect to any medical condition, mental health issue, or health inquiry, including matters discussed on this podcast. This episode discusses abuse, which may be triggering to some people. The views and opinions expressed are solely those of the podcast author or individuals participating in the podcast and do not represent the opinions of Red Table Talk Productions, iHeartMedia, or their employees. Joe, it is such a pleasure to have you here. Your story is actually one of the most profound and extreme examples of post-separation abuse I've heard. Let's talk about the man you ended up marrying. So how old were you when you met
16.
Him? How did the two of you meet?
I was out for a walk with a girlfriend of mine, and we were going by Union College, which is close to my home. And we were just like, I've never been in a fraternity house. Have you ever been in a fraternity house? And we like, let's go check it out. We just wandered in thinking it was like going into a Starbucks or something. I don't know what we were thinking. But we started going up the stairs, and just maybe a few steps up, this guy stops us and says, hey, excuse me, ladies, can I help you? And he was smiling and was like, we're just looking around. And he's like, all right. And he let us go. And then when we came back down the stairs, he introduced himself, and it was my husband to be, Lou. We stayed for dinner and we chatted and called my house the next day and asked me out on a date.
Okay.
So we went out to dinner. I made it very clear before when we were even talking that I had a boyfriend, Gino, and I wasn't looking to date anyone. He said, I have a girlfriend too. I'm like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. this is fine. We can be friends.
Okay. So how did the relationship unfold from that point going forward?
So it kind of went off the rails pretty quickly, actually, even just as friends. So he had wanted me to go to like a fraternity mm-hmm. picnic maybe a couple weeks later. So at the time, Gino was still my boyfriend, although it was a long distance relationship. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, no, Gino's coming to visit.
Ah.
So I can't. Mm-hmm. And he was clearly not happy about it. So Gino came with a friend and my friend and I went to meet with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they, I had to go home for something. I came back where we were supposed to meet and he was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, there were no cell phones back then. There was right, there no, was no, absolutely no yeah, way to get in touch with someone back then
mm-hmm.
who you didn't know where they were.
Yep.
And I was distraught. I was totally abandoned by Gino. I was irrationally looking all over town on foot mm-hmm. with my friend. And the only person I knew with a car was Lou.
Okay. And Lou is the guy from the fraternity house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gave mm-hmm. me a ride home.
Okay.
But then the next day he called. He wanted to talk about what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And from my perspective, I had just called a friend for a ride. From his perspective, this woman that he was dating had blown him off on a date, gone on a date with someone else, and then called looking for free transportation. And instead of it being a conversation, he was driving fast and erratically. And like at first I was apologizing for what I did because I saw it when he said, all right, you did this thing to me, and I saw it and I'm like, oh, okay, I'm sorry. You're right. That was kind of a crappy thing for me to do.
So the crappy thing you did was called him for a ride because you had been abandoned by Gino.
Right.
Was that why he was driving fast? Did that seem like a reaction to that because he was so upset?
Oh, yeah. He was mad about how I treated him.
Mm-hmm.
So he was embarrassed that I didn't go on this picnic with his friends. I was scared to death. He wouldn't let me out of the car. He did take me home, but I shut the door and, like, have a nice life. I thought I was never going to see him again.
Okay. And you're 16. You're young. How old was Lou at this time?
He's 5 years older than me.
So 21. 16 to 21 is big.
Yep.
Developmentally, it's big in every which way. You were still a kid in many ways. He was coming into adulthood. So you have a lot going on. You've been abandoned by one guy who was having a tantrum. And then, and honestly, this other guy was having a tantrum.
Good point.
I got to say this, though, Joe, that fast driving thing, that's actually a red flag everyone can pay attention to. There's actually some interesting research on this, that these kinds of antagonistic, narcissistic personality styles are associated with dangerous driving. And that can show up early in a relationship because somebody's mad, or even that they're showing off, or they get mad about another driver. And I'll tell people, if you see someone driving real angry early in a relationship when it's easy to get out, because this is a marker for a bunch of other stuff. So you slam the door, get out of the car with Lou. You think you're never going to see him again. So then what happens?
Then a little time goes by. I get a call. He needed to come back to Schenectady because things weren't going well with his parents and mm-hmm. they were kicking him out and he needed a place to live. And did I know a place that he could live?
Mm-hmm.
So I went and looked for him, you know, and then tried to get back in touch saying, oh, I found this place, that place. I called the house a few times, left messages with his family, didn't hear anything back. And I was like, all right, whatever. And then went about my way. By that time, I had broken up with Gino.
Interesting, though, to me, throw the tantrum, drive the car that, but then he doesn't think anything much of calling you up, because I think that's actually a big ask of someone
to help,
especially a 16, 17-year-old. Right? To say, hey, help me find a place to live. It's a big thing to ask.
Right.
And so you do. And he comes back in September. You've broken up with Gino. So what happens now?
So what happens now is, I can't explain why. I thought it would be a good idea to go visit at the fraternity house. I was totally emotionally a wreck.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't looking to have a new boyfriend,
mm-hmm,
at
mm-hmm.
least not consciously.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, thought that Lou and I could be friends.
Okay. Okay. So I want to frame that a little, okay? Because you were 16 years old.
This time I had turned 17. Okay, I just turned a whopping 17.
Not 30. You're 16. You're 17. There's a guy who's older than you. You had a nice encounter. He clearly throws tantrums when he doesn't get his way. You saw that. Drives erratically. Asks for a favor. You do it at 16. He doesn't communicate. Joe, the vast majority of adults wouldn't pick up those red flags. Okay, so you're getting into it with him. This still doesn't sound like a relationship to me.
No, it was after a few weeks of him being back at college and he knew I wasn't seeing Gino anymore, mm-hmm. he started to press for well, so why aren't we going out now? Mm-hmm. You're not seeing him anymore.
Okay.
I didn't have a good reason. Mm-hmm. And so it kissed for this first time and started acting more like boyfriend, girlfriend.
Okay. Let's fast forward a little bit. You do get engaged to this person. How did that happen?
Following year, a girlfriend of mine wanted to go on a cruise. Mm-hmm. And I thought that would be fun. Agreed to go with her. And obviously Lou was not. Now it's obvious that he would not be happy with me doing such a thing.
Right.
He pitched quite a few fits about me going on this trip, but I didn't care mm-hmm. about his complaints. I was going. This was something I wanted to do. I had no intention of being long-term mm-hmm. in our relationship. So I went on the cruise, and while I was on the cruise, I got paged, getting paged on a cruise ship.
It was like
the overhead.
Somebody says, Joe, please come and mm-hmm. there's a phone call for you. Yeah, okay.
Yep. When I got the call through, it was, and it's weird, it sounds like a sonic thing. I've never even heard it on a movie, kind of what it sounds like, but it was like, will you marry me? It was like a really bizarre sound on ship-to-shore calls back then. I was like, shit. Huh. That was but he was barely speaking to me when I left. He was so mad.
Because you were going on the cruise.
Because I was going on the mm-hmm. on the cruise. And so my reaction was it was dread. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But what came out of my mouth was, yes.
When you think back to that day, Joe, are you able to connect back into yourself in a way emotionally to think about where that yes came from?
Even for that amount of time, I had the sense that he was dependent on me.
Ah, okay, okay.
Mm-hmm. He was dependent on me for his well-being. Mm-hmm. So whether it was talking him down from being upset about something with, mm-hmm. so he was always upset about something with somebody. People do what they do. And he would react very strongly to whatever people would do. Mm-hmm. And so there were all kinds mm-hmm. of offenses that I would run interference to keep things from bothering him in the first place. I helped him with schoolwork. He wasn't doing well in school. Mm. I would, if he was reading a book for a paper, I read the same book. Mm. I took a lot of the same classes, basically. Even though I was going to school also, I was helping him along. He was estranged from his family. He was all on his own. His dad had stopped supporting his school financially when he hurt his knee and he had to stop playing football. Mm-hmm. So financially, I was also supporting. So I was working full time and going to school full time. I felt very needed, and it's not like in a good way. It's not like, oh, he needs me.
Mm-hmm. No, I understand. The trauma bond can often begin through the belief that we need to help someone. For somebody as young as Joe, who subsequently did feel needed, with time, she then felt responsible for him, which would keep her stuck. She had a role and function in this relationship, and this sense of responsibility is often what underlies people getting stuck in unhealthy relationships. And so, since he needed you, it seems like that was a big driver in you saying yes. I guess the corollary to that would be, what did you think might have happened if you said no?
Just like saying I'm going to go on this 1-week cruise was a big deal.
Right.
and there's so much anger and many fights. Like, and he would get physical, and he wasn't physical with me. He was physical with stuff, you know, rip stuff, bang on stuff. You know, just visceral feeling from these fights. I knew that if I said no to getting married, it wasn't going to be okay, have a nice life. I knew all hell would break loose.
Okay, so you're 17, okay?
18? I just turned 18.
18. That makes him 23. You're kind of taking full responsibility for another adult who sounds like a petulant, tantruming child, who is reacting strongly, who is always angry about things, who's huffing and puffing, who is financially reliant on you. I'm going to say it again, an 18-year-old girl. And I guess my question then is, there was some fear. Were you afraid?
Well, I had seen what happened when he doesn't get his way. And it's not pretty. Anytime he was mad at somebody, he wasn't shy about showing his disappointment and his anger and placing blame. And if he would have just said, you know, I'm just going to leave you behind, I would have been okay with that. I wasn't afraid of him leaving me, ever.
Right, right.
I was never afraid of him leaving me.
You were afraid of his reactions.
I was afraid of his anger.
It's interesting. Early in the game, you already saw what that post-separation abuse was going to look like. If this guy doesn't get his way, the consequences are so dire that it's easier to appease him. And that's where I call sort of tantrums as manipulation. One of the things I take fault with the field of even mental health of, well, a person has a choice when someone's having a tantrum, they can step away. But it's not that simple, right? There's all the psychological dynamics in us of we like to feel needed, we want to feel helpful, we might feel obligated, be around family roles, gender roles, whatever. And having these tantrums became a form of manipulation because over time, you were living your life to keep the tantrums at bay.
Especially the ones that seem to be my fault.
Correct. Which, so over time, I'm sure everything became your fault.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So you get married. Once you got married, what was your relationship like?
So he got accepted to Duke University, their MBA program.
That's a big deal.
Helped him write his application.
Right. So you basically, you got accepted to Duke University for their MBA program is what happened. You own that. So, yeah.
Helped. I worked. And he was going to school. Like, I used to just, I would wake up in the morning and just have this help me. Like, like my first thought in the morning was like a silent scream of help me.
You waited a while to have children. You didn't have a child until 12 years into the marriage. You get pregnant. And can you tell me about the day that you found out you got pregnant?
Yeah. So we had been trying for a few months, and then I did pee on the stick, and it was positive, and I was like so excited. And Lou was getting ready to go on a trip. He was a consultant at that point, and so he was traveling a lot. And by this point, I knew he was cheating a lot. He came in the bedroom, and I came out with the thing, and I said, "Look," and he's like, "Oh, okay." And I said, "Oh?"
You showed him a positive pregnancy test after you'd been trying for months, and his reaction was, "Oh."
"Oh." And I said, "Oh." Mm-hmm. And okay. He goes, "All right, well, I don't know what you, congratulations, what do you expect me to say?" And then he like gave me a little peck and said, I gotta go. And he went on his trip. I think the part I haven't really explained is he was also very charming.
Okay.
So I haven't really explained the forward-facing persona. When anybody would meet him on a professional basis, he's the big smile, glad hand. He was an expert in his field, so to speak. Normal people, when they would meet, he was laughing and joking around about things. So he wasn't just this grumpy jerk until somebody irritated him.
Okay, so he would be charming and charismatic. People were drawn to him. Maybe did that play a role even back when he was at Union and he was a student?
He had it back then. So when he met my parents, they were impressed.
Okay, all right. So he had this charm and charisma, and only when he would be frustrated or disappointed would this kind of crack show up, and then he would be quick to react.
Yeah. So, you know, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. Mr. Hyde would come out when someone didn't go his
right.
way.
Did other people see that?
People saw one or the other for the most part. So there are plenty of people who never saw that side of Lou that was angry. Like a lot of times he would bring it home, and then other times he would flip out in a store.
Okay. All
so
right. So
he would occasionally flip out in a public setting, and I would be like, you know, dial it back, you know.
Okay.
We still need to get our food here kind of thing.
Do you feel like mostly he brought it home?
Mostly he brought it home or he was covert about how he would get his revenge on someone.
In these 12 years, what I'm hearing is there were some good times. Mr. Charm would show up and you would have fun. Was every morning waking up with dread for 12 years before you found out you were pregnant?
Oh, gosh, no.
No. Okay.
No, we did lots of things. We would go hiking. And within a certain week, there would be good and bad times. But
so there were good times. There were also these tantrums. You get this lukewarm reaction from him. And you're pregnant now. Tell me about the day then your daughter was actually born.
He was miserable throughout
Why?
My pregnancy. Why? He projected a horrible life to follow. I was going to get fat. I was going to get ugly. We were going to have, he called it a life of crumminess ahead.
Okay. Was he not in on the wanting to get pregnant in the first place? Or was that just, was that something you wanted and he agreed to? Was he ever enthusiastic about? There I'm a little bit confused because it seemed like he was into it.
He was into it before we actually got pregnant.
Okay.
Like even during the process of getting pregnant, he was 100% into it.
Right.
But that was a light switch moment when I showed him the stick. And
interesting. Okay.
And then after that, he just got increasingly down about the whole thing.
So it was more of that withdrawal again. I mean, it almost feels like that pattern got reproduced again there as well.
I was sure he was going to leave me.
We will be right back with this conversation.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Oh, okay. All right.
I was okay with that.
And you're okay with that. Despite we had fun hiking and there was this charming guy, by and large, the dread woman from the early years of the marriage, that never left. So the entire marriage, it was sort of, I kind of wish this guy would just go away, but I'm not going to end it.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have a baby. Did you stay in the same house that you were in, or did you ever have to do anything like that? Like look for a house together?
So that whole process was a complete disaster. Every house that we looked at was unacceptable. And from silly little things like, oh, that has a dead tree in front. If they would leave a dead tree in front, what kind of things are they hiding inside the house? You couldn't have neighbors being too close to you. You couldn't have, it can be the best house in the neighborhood. It couldn't be the worst house in the neighborhood. You can't have neighbors too close. And I picked a spot in the middle of an 11-acre lot. And that's where we determined that we could build. So we were living in temporary, like a condo.
And how did all of that go?
Awful. The builder at one point sent an email saying that he was no longer willing to talk to Lou or communicate with Lou or see Lou. He was micromanaging everything on the property, and then he would blow up, explode to the point where at one point he damaged his vocal cords by yelling so much and thought he broke bones in his hand from like pounding his fist while he was yelling at the guy.
Okay. So you're back to traditional reactive tantruming Lou. How are you feeling emotionally?
I was furious with
him. You're angry.
I was angry. I knew he was cheating and all kinds of every port in the storm. He had something going on wherever he was going.
So he was still traveling for work.
And so he was constantly on the hunt for people locally and people, like if he had a client out in Pennsylvania, he'd be hunting there. If he had a client and he had one in Oregon, he had one in California, he was hunting all the time. And, you know, so even though he was telling me, you know, no, I'm not doing anything, but if you keep pestering me and nagging me about this, it will happen. Mm-hmm, you're going to make this a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. So yeah, at this point, he was had taken up bodybuilding as a hobby. And he found a new girlfriend.
Okay.
But he wasn't hiding it from me anymore.
Okay.
So it went from undercover relationships that I knew about, but for whatever reason, you probably know, I don't, but didn't call him out on him, to in-my-face relationship.
What does it mean, in-your-face?
Like I knew.
And he
we
knew
talked,
you knew.
And he knew I knew. And he actually would make me clear out from our townhouse sometimes, for she had an open relationship with her husband. So it was kind of sanctioned on her side at first. But then when they got too chummy, then her husband was calling it out.
Okay, so I need to understand this. You're renting a townhouse, you're building a house, you have a daughter, you're married. Mm-hmm. You didn't call him out on past infidelity. So there was no conversation there. There was never like an explosive, I know you're cheating, nothing. He would cheat, you knew it, and you looked the other way.
For the most part, yeah. I would call out the hunting behavior, and he would deny the hunting for somebody.
Okay.
And then say, if I kept it up, I was going to cause the relationship.
Okay,
and it would be my fault.
I understand that. But
so I didn't even bother saying.
Okay. So now he's got this new one.
Mm-hmm.
You're all living in a townhouse. He's asking you to leave the townhouse so he can have his girlfriend over to have sex with her.
Because she made him happy.
Because she made him happy. Okay. So now there's no not seeing it. Like here I am. This is, to me, the read I would have on this, as anyone listening to this, is he is trying to make you leave the marriage.
Yeah, and it gets worse. Yeah.
Okay.
He was like, oh, you know, her husband is a bad guy because, you know, he said no. She's like, this is abusive. She should actually move in with us and we should, you know, pay for her to go to college.
Okay, and holy sister wives. Like, what is happening? So he is saying, I need to take this in, okay?
I do too.
Up till now, I got to say, I'm like, okay, this just sounds like an unhappy relationship. Until, let's run the girlfriend mentorship program in our house, yep, and move this woman in, pay her tuition. You're not in an open relationship.
No.
How are you
responding? Not voluntarily.
How are you responding to this?
I'm pushing back, saying, no, we can't be doing this. And then he would get mad and he would blow up. And then I would get beat down verbally, emotionally, you know, about how horrible his life is. And this is the only thing that makes him happy. And, you know, because we're living in a townhouse. How horrible.
I almost feel like a student in a classroom. Like, question. Okay. In any story like this, okay, a person who is so enamored of their side person would move out. They'd say, I've met someone, I love them, or I fall in love, or whatever, and I'm going to go rent my own place. Bye. My lawyer will be in touch with you about the details. I've heard that story before, and it's a devastating, heartbreaking story. The idea that someone's leaving you for someone else is the ultimate in abandonment. I understand that story. He's asking you to adjust to this.
Correct. And he didn't want to leave. And I don't think she wanted him. I think she could see what an unpleasant person he could be. So she was getting all the good stuff. But I think she could also see how he was acting towards me. So it's not like she was wanting to leave her husband. Lou asked her to leave
her
husband.
To move full time into your townhouse with you and your daughter.
The new house.
The new house.
Yeah. And then he asked me to talk to her and encourage her to do so.
Okay. So here's the thing.
Can't make it up.
You can't make it. I mean, my head is spinning with the utter lack of empathy. You know, I've heard variants on this. The father having an inappropriate relationship with like a live-in nanny or an au pair, right? But this is a person he gets into a relationship with, but it seems like there's almost zero self-awareness that this is a completely inappropriate thing to ask for. That, do you understand what I'm saying? Like,
he thought he was better than most husbands that go out drinking and go to bars and hang out with their friends and go play, you know, go to sports games. He thinks this is...
So having a girlfriend that you move into the house is on the same level as having a beer with somebody and watching a Patriots game.
Better than, yeah.
But it's not planet Earth, at least not the United States planet Earth.
And if I cared about him, I would want him to be happy.
Okay, so this is manipulation on such a high level. I've got to tell you, you might have broken a new sort of world speed record on navigating narcissism, and that takes some doing. Because we've heard stuff here, but the idea that you are in a presumptively monogamous marriage with someone who is asking you to do this, how were you feeling at this point?
So this is when I started having spells of lightheadedness, and my heart was racing, and mm-hmm. I would feel dizzy, and I would have to like suddenly sit down. I thought I was having a heart attack a few times. I went to the doctor thinking, all right, there's something wrong with my heart. And Lou knew that I was having these physical reactions. The physical test came back negative for any issues. Then they asked, all right, well, what's going on in your private life? Mm-hmm. And I talked about the stress of moving, trying to find a house and move and build a house, and that we'd been fighting because of the stress of the move. And then they said, you have anxiety-induced depression.
It sounds like you're having panic attacks. I mean, those lightheaded, dizzy, and that, heart attack moments were panic attacks.
Correct. And that those episodes were panic attacks. So they basically said you have depression, anxiety, and you're experiencing panic attacks.
Okay.
And then they started medication.
Did you mention to the medical team you're working with, and by the way, my husband is having an affair and wants to move his affair partner into the house while we remain married. Did you share that tidbit with them?
No.
Okay, because that's a big one, right? And it's interesting you didn't. It really, really is. What do you think drove that decision to not share that piece of it?
It's embarrassing even to talk about now, because I would say that anybody would just say, screw this, and leave.
See, I want to put your feet to the fire on that, Joe, because this isn't about you. This is about that somebody thought this was okay to do this to you. You're absolutely right. A lot of people would say, come on now, get up, find your, you know, get out of there. What's wrong with you? You know, absolutely not. I think I am having this shocked reaction because what this person did was shocking and remorseless and unempathic. And when we are in the wake of that kind of behavior, we have panic attacks. It's almost as though a short circuiting in the system starts to take place. We're experiencing this cataclysmic fear, but we can't give word to it. And so I fully, fully empathize with the sense of embarrassment that one would feel about sharing this. But I really want to put a fine point on this. You weren't doing anything. You were living a life. And there's nothing foolish about what you did. You had a family, you had a child. And we had a guest on this podcast named Dr. Jennifer Fried, who talks about betrayal blindness, that when we are betrayed, there is a not seeing it that can happen and not acknowledging it. And she even uses this interesting term of it whooshes away. Just you see this guy, there's no not seeing this. He's, I'm going to move this person in. And while there was certainly this moment of in the doctor's office not wanting to share with them the wholeness of what was happening, there was a placing it aside. So how did you talk about this in your marriage?
So we would go through these cycles where I would say, all right, you can't keep doing this. This has to stop. I need to have some self-respect, and mm-hmm. you need to show me respect. I understand this is what makes you happy, but it's not fair to me. Imagine being me. And then he would just blow up and beat me down and then claim that I had set him up for this, that somehow I was responsible for him being in this position of having this relationship that he now cannot live without. And then he would claim that I had said everything was okay and that I was fine with it. And I was like, I never.
That's gaslighting.
Never, ever did I ever. Mm-hmm. So yes, a couple times I went along with it because you beat me down.
And what did going along with it look like?
Like me leaving the apartment.
I see. And so somebody's gaslighting you. Someone's manipulating you. You're upside down. So you'll sometimes almost seem like it's agreement, mm-hmm. right? Like you're in it. That's the end. That's the end of the gaslighting cycle. Very few people get all the way down into the sort of the bottom floor of the whole gaslighting process.
I remember just like literally being on the floor during these arguments and him, you know, beating on a chair,
yeah.
you know, and insisting that this was my fault and that my emotional problem goes way back and it has nothing to do with him or her.
Right.
And that it's, you know, this is all about like when I got pregnant that, you know, my issues date way back then and it's got nothing to do with now. And like, all right, I agree that I've had emotional issues for a long time, but this has taken it to a whole new level.
He's making it about your emotional issues at this mm-hmm. point. Your emotional issues, tracking them back to the pregnancy. You're even sitting here saying, I acknowledge I have emotional issues. You do realize that the vast majority of these emotional issues sound like they were caused by being married to a man like this.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I'm not, you know what I'm saying?
I get it now.
You weren't presenting with a history of anxiety and depression by your reports, even growing up. He's telling you you're the one with the problem. Mm-hmm. So where do you go with that?
So I wrote a long letter because like, whatever I say, he said it, I didn't say it. So if I send an email, then I'll have it in writing and I could like pull out my documentation and prove, no, this is what I said. See, it says it right here.
Yeah.
So I wrote this really long letter saying, you know, exactly how I felt about everything. I acknowledged, you know, my part to the extent that I have a part, but I let it happen. I acknowledged my part and said, this isn't healthy for me. It's not good for me. I can't do this. If you want to pursue this, I will be a good co-parent, basically, mm-hmm. with you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
I wish you all the best. I want you to be happy. I want me to be happy, too, though. So I cannot live this way.
Okay.
And so don't be thinking that I approve in any sense. I never have.
Right.
You know, there are times when I said, do what you want, but I didn't say I'm okay with it. It was a very loving mm-hmm. letter.
Writing long letters in order to feel heard is a telltale sign you're being gaslighted and maybe dealing with a narcissist. Remember, narcissists are all about power, control, and domination. Arguing just to get your point across can be destabilizing and unsettling as they use tactics like gaslighting and fast-paced pressured speech to overwhelm and dominate the conversation. They always try to win the argument. If you find yourself writing long letters or text messages to explain yourself, it may be a sign that you are in a toxic relationship.
His response was, first, he didn't even acknowledge that he got it. And then he said, oh, yeah. Yeah, I got that. We decided that there's too much pressure on us. So we're not going to see each other anymore. I'm like, this means you're going to go underground, basically.
So he's going to go seek out new supply. I mean, because that's what these other women are. They're sources of narcissistic supply or, you know, that's really what it sounds like. So this is the too much pressure is basically your letter saying, if you want to pursue this, but I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
And him saying then, well, that's too much pressure. In essence, he can't have both things. He can't just basically openly have this relationship in this townhouse, in your presence, meant that he actually had to make a choice. So he said, okay, I'm going to end that relationship with her. How did that feel?
I was so proud of my letter. And I really thought, okay, this is, he's going to like have his aha, you know, like, oh, I get it now. I see what I, yeah. No, it was, I was like, now what, you know?
So now what?
Yeah, now what? And so now he pretended that they weren't seeing each other anymore. And,
but they were.
But they were. At one point, he gave her an ultimatum, basically. because he wasn't happy with sharing her anymore with her husband. So he gave her an ultimatum, and she's like, yeah, I'm just going to focus on my marriage now. And she ended it with him.
Okay, so she ended it. When we're talking about mechanics, we're talking about, you know, the absurdity of it all. Were you hurt?
I was hoping that they would decide to be together. I was thinking this was my potential out.
So you really were looking for the out. But it seemed that him ending that relationship meant you didn't have your out.
Correct.
Even though you always had your out.
I didn't see an out.
You didn't see an out. Because you were afraid of what?
That's the same reason I said yes to getting married in the first place. The vague, I'm going to deal with your wrath.
Okay, so you were still afraid of his wrath. You were afraid of his anger. And so if he was with the new gal, in theory, well, he's got a safe place to land. He's got his person. He's all sorted. So then you could get up and leave. And it would be less of a, there'd be less of this reaction. Did this house ever get built?
Yeah, so the house got built. She stopped seeing him, but he went right back to hunting.
Sure.
For relationships. And I saw that and I'm like, I didn't even unpack my stuff. So we moved into the house and I unpacked just about everything, but my stuff was still in boxes. I started to talk to people more. So mm-hmm. I talked to one of my sisters. I shared with her, you know, some of the relationship issues with him and how he was behaving with the house hunting and the build and the other women. And she was supportive. And it was like amazing to me after all these years of not talking to anybody that there was support.
Right.
So now suddenly people are starting to give me advice, but also saying, well, that's not cool. The way he treats me is not okay. It's not normal. People don't do that. And it's bizarre that you need somebody to tell you it's not your fault. And, you know, they're not acting that way because of what you did. They're acting that way because of who they are.
So now you've got support. You're talking to people, but you're still living in the same house as this guy. Okay. Your stuff isn't fully unpacked. There's a part of you that seems psychologically resistant. At this point, the wheels are off, right? Your husband is basically having a series of multiple relationships with other people. Another piece of this story is also that Lou was a private pilot.
We owned a private airplane.
Yeah, so I know that there was a part of your story that I'd like to have you share is that you and your daughter and he were on an airplane and something became very clear to you at that point. Could you share some of that?
Yeah. So I said, all right, I want a divorce. Mm-hmm. We are going to divorce. And he wasn't having it. He admitted to a sexual addiction. And he would only go to counseling of any sort if I agreed to stay together. But the counseling he wanted to sign up for was sexual addiction counseling.
Just as an aside, sex addiction is there's a phenomenology there. There's no two ways about it. Okay. It is, we see it come out in multiple different ways. Pornography, hiring people to have sex with somebody, going on, like nowadays is a million different ways you could find a person to have, you know, sex anywhere with you. It's dysregulated. The addiction term is meant that the person feels that they almost can't control the urge. While there is some talk of love addiction, it really is, sex addiction is, it's not relational, right? It is about sex, masturbation, pornography, short-term sexual hits, whatever. It's not about somebody showing up and saying, I want to move my girlfriend into our home. That's not sex addiction. And I think that the commandeering of the sex addiction defense, people who study it, they'll see that there's a whole picture there. There's often a lot of remorse. There's often a lot of shame. And in therapy, there's often a lot of work on trauma and all. It's just very complicated, right? Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, I had moved out of our bedroom and he was just getting increasingly weird and weirder and weirder and weirder. And then he had made appointments for dental work for all three of us back in Delaware. So we haul ourselves back to Delaware. And while we were on the plane, I'm in the co-pilot's seat and Angelica's in the back and he's flying. And all of a sudden I had an overwhelming clarity that he intended to crash the plane with all three of us in it on purpose. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just sitting there and I'm like, because, you know, he had been getting weirder and weirder the more it became clear I was determined to leave. Mm-hmm. And had made threats, mm-hmm. vague threats, mm-hmm. but nothing specific. And I was like, oh my God, he's going to kill all of us. Mm-hmm. And I sat there and I'm like, all right, if he's going to put the plane in a dive, all right, there's a knife here. I'm going to grab this knife here. I'm going to blind him. And then I can, once he's blinded, I could kill him, because, you know, you can't fight back from that. And I know how to operate the plane myself. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm not a pilot, but mm-hmm. I can do it, and I can dial in for help and figured all that out. And none of that happened. Clearly, none of that happened.
Right. Okay.
But when we got back that night safely, I was determined that there was serious, serious danger.
My conversation will continue after this break.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Gut sense that it's not safe, it's not okay to leave, it's not safe to leave. So we got back home. I finally got my stuff together mm-hmm. to decide to leave and came up with a plan. I called. My sister had given me the phone number for the domestic violence support and called it and explained not everything clearly, but enough, and got the feedback that you're not crazy. And if you don't feel safe, you're probably not. You should leave with a safety plan.
Yeah.
So I decided that I was going to pack up a few things in the back of the car and go see a lawyer, which I was forbidden from doing, but I did it anyway. In that one day, I found a lawyer to see me, mm-hmm. Agree to help me. I gave him a retainer, and my intention was to go pick up Angelica from camp and then just take off with her before he even got home.
Okay.
But I don't know if he had a sense that something was unusual. And for the first time ever, he went and picked her up mm-hmm. From camp. So I was like, now I gotta figure something mm-hmm. else. And then we needed to take a car to service. Mm-hmm. And so Lou and I met up. I got Angelica in the back seat with me, my car, which was a bit of a trick because Lou's like, he wants to drive that car. And I was like, oh, I felt like an actress. I'm like, oh, you drive it on the way back. You know, I'll follow you over there. You drive, we'll drop the car off and then I'll follow you back. And then when we were getting off an exit to where the car dealership was, I slowed down and then I kind of darted back down mm-hmm. and on the highway and just gunned it. Mm-hmm. And then he noticed I wasn't behind him after he made the turn, and then he called me on the cell phone and like, oh, did you miss the turn? Or, you know, I'm like, yeah, I need a break. This has just been too much, and I saw a lawyer filing for divorce. I suggest you go see a lawyer too. I let him talk to Angelica. I explained to Angelica on the drive before I took off what was going to happen, mm-hmm. and just said, you know, clearly we've been fighting. He called. I just kept saying, I just need peace, mm-hmm. please. I just need peace. And went to one hotel.
So now you and Angelica are staying in hotels.
We stayed at a hotel that night.
One night. Then?
And then the next day went to back to the lawyer's office as planned. The attorney said, this is clearly emotional abuse.
Good for him.
Domestic
or
abuse.
Good for her.
And he was someone who had been trained. So then I go to the courthouse.
Right.
We had written up an affidavit and I wrote up a petition for a restraining order. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to get a restraining order. The attorney is the one who told me you really mm-hmm. need it because this is the only thing that you can use to stop him from constantly calling you
okay.
and harassing you.
Okay.
And this is how you can have temporary custody of your daughter.
Okay. So you take the paperwork for the temporary restraining order to the courthouse.
Yep.
And?
meeting with the judge. He hears it all. And he said, I'll grant this. This is a 1 month temporary restraining order.
And so you got it. Mm-hmm. So now, how did that work? That they would still serve him to let him know that it's in.
Yeah. So around 10:30 at night, I got a call from the police saying they were getting ready to serve.
To serve. Okay.
And they wanted to know details about the house and guns and and stuff. And I explained all that. And he's not somebody that you want to disregard. If he takes like a "you're not going to take me out of here" stance, he means it.
Okay.
You know, and they're like, oh, you know, we deal with this stuff all the time. And
does that go off without incident?
So they call me back and say, you know, he put up a resistance at first, but he gave in, went in and got his computer and some stuff and said he was going to go to a hotel.
Okay, so he's gone to his own hotel.
Yep.
He just still doesn't know where you are.
Right.
Okay, now it's the next day. Now what happens?
7:20 in the morning, I get a phone call on my cell phone and I see it's Lou.
Okay.
I'm like, yeah, it didn't surprise me because I really didn't expect him to abide by the order.
Right.
I don't want him to get in trouble. And I also don't want him to have an opportunity to leave me a nasty voicemail because he had been leaving me like really nasty stuff.
Okay. So you, 7:20 in the morning, he violates the order. He calls you. You don't report it to the police. Then what happens?
About maybe a half hour later, I get a call about our alarm system. And they said the panic alarm in your master bedroom has gone off.
You're getting a phone call about that?
From the security company.
Got it.
And I'm like, oh. I said, nobody should be there. Please notify the police. Nobody should be there. And if that's happening, then there's a real problem.
So then
pacing around and then call the police. And I said, you know, I've been waiting for a call back. And they're like, oh, my God, thank you for calling. An airplane crashed into your house and it's fully engulfed in flames and we need you to go to the property now to help the responders. I got there and the entire development was just all emergency vehicles, police, ambulance, fire trucks from multiple towns and the media was already there.
Because a plane crashed into a house. Like that's a plane, thing.
The neighbors called it in.
And right. And that's what made the panic alarm go off.
The plane crash made it go off.
Okay. So you get to your house. There is a plane crashed into your house.
Obviously, the police had the records of me going to the police department, them serving the restraining order. So they knew that that was an incident house.
I see.
So their biggest concern was that we were in the house more than anything else. So for them, it was kind of like, all right, this is not as bad as it could have been.
Because you and your daughter weren't in the house.
Because we were not in the house.
Okay. So what went through your head when you got to the house?
I was scared that he somehow had managed to do this and make it look like maybe he was dead too, but that he wasn't.
Oh, so you suspected it was him. As soon as you heard plane crash in the house, you suspected it was him? Okay, which would be reasonable because planes don't crash into houses.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking it was a coincidence.
No, no. I mean, a plane could crash and land in a street or in a neighborhood or in a yard and harm a house, but this went right into the house.
Yeah, and this was in the middle of a clearing.
Oh, yeah.
Out of an 11 acre.
Uh-huh.
It was a very precision attack.
So it isn't, but that jumps out at me that what went through your head was that I know it's him and my concern is that he is still alive.
Somehow. I had to lay out the schematics of the house, speak, for them, and then explained about Lou's stature and, you know, identifying features. And so that when they did get to the plane, because they hadn't gotten to the plane itself yet, it was all based on the neighbors saying what they saw with the airplane circling before the crash.
Okay.
So when they said, yeah, we did find a body and it matches your description or the remains match your description because clearly there was a fire. The house was just a skeleton.
So now you know he's dead. There's a body, there's remains. You can't, you know, I mean, and it was clearly him, okay? It had to have been extraordinarily difficult time. You've lost your home. You've gone through the terror of leaving this relationship. You knew it was going to be bad. It certainly doesn't sound like you ever thought it was going to be this.
And the hardest part was telling Angelica what had happened. So that was horrible. And then later that night, having to call his mother and his sister and, you know, call my family, you know, but calling his mother was really tough. But then after that, it was really media. Media was relentless. It was very interesting to the world.
Yeah.
That was August 25th.
Of 2001.
And then in the morning of September 11th.
2001.
My friend, one of the ones who had been a real support person and my closest friend, he called. He said, "Are you watching TV?" So, what channel? I wasn't. He goes, "Any." And I turned on the TV and, you know, the images that were going. So now I had, oh my God, like, is this my fault? Because it had been national, not just national news, it was international news. It was everywhere, you know, about what he had done, and kamikaze pilot, and burns down his house and crashes into the house. And I felt responsible. And even though I know it's not, like, I go through like, okay, they were probably just going to hijack those planes, you know, like, but they got this idea from Lou to like do this instead with crashing into buildings. And like, oh my God, this is all my fault. And everyone's going to know this is my fault. And so yeah, little PTSD from from that alone.
I think
on top of
probably
other things years for years.
It's the trauma survivors blame themselves for things that have nothing to do with them. It's part of the architecture of trauma, a throwback to trying to attempt to make some sense of control over something that was happening. And the proximity of something that was such a catastrophic event in your life against an image that was so similar 2 weeks later is, I mean, you were in the throes of acute trauma at that point. When 9/11 happened, it was
like 17 days.
Yeah. You know, so we consider that acute traumatic stress. Most people will continue to have trauma responses within that 30-day period. Most people will then, you know, sort of, there will be a tailing off and it'll leave a toll but may not cause impairment in their life. But that connection of those two events took what was already your daughter's grief. It was her father. And this is not the end you wanted. You wanted the two of you to be able to go off into your own separate lives. Mm-hmm. This is not what you had hoped for. And then you also still lived in fear right until the very last moment that he was still alive and could harm you. This was a person who felt dangerous to you. But I want to now focus in the years later, because your daughter Angelica is now an adult, right? She's grown up and she will go into relationships now. What did you talk to her about when she started dating?
Honestly, she's been married now for 7 years.
Wow.
She's married to her first and only boyfriend.
Wow. Okay.
That she started dating in high school. But before she dated him, you know, I did talk to her and one of her girlfriends. And her girlfriend was maybe a little more interested in boys than Angelica was at the time. And I talked to them about my experience. And
good. Good.
You know, and I talked about the earlier times with even before Lou, you know, and mistakes I made, and not things are dangerous. It's more about the self-respect and, you know, don't settle for things that aren't right. If something doesn't feel right, it's not right.
Yeah.
Just basically, if you don't feel good, if in a relationship, it's probably not good for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough. That's tough advice for young people to listen to. So how have you been healing? What's your healing process been like?
I'm married to a good guy.
Oh, good. You know, congratulations.
He's a good guy and he's been through his share of bad experiences himself. So in general, we're really good to each other.
Good. But you trusted love enough to get married again, which is amazing.
I never thought I would.
Yeah.
I keep a very tight circle. So I feel really vulnerable outside of this circle. But I'm great with my circle.
Yeah, that's great.
I actually have a few circles.
I think the small circle idea is actually very much the landscape of survivorship. I always say your relationship with trust is going to change, right? Now, I want to ask you one last question, which is, if you could talk to your 16-year-old self who had just met Lou in the stairwell of a frat house, what would you tell her?
Well, I'm going to preface this by, you know, I'm like, to change anything is to change everything. And then mm-hmm, I don't have right. Angelica.
That's good for you. I'm glad you said that.
So I wouldn't change a thing that resulted in not having her in my life. But my instincts were right when I got out of the car after the speeding. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So everything was fine up till then. Yep. You know, there's, you know, even though there was a couple awkward things, you know, with the early dates, but, or not date, whatever those were. But my instinct when I got out of that car and slammed it and said, that's it, we're right. There was no reason to go back and test the waters again.
Yes. And yet most people do. But I really want to come back to what you said. To change anything would be to change everything. It was such, I've never heard anyone quite say it that way, Joe, and I'm really glad we're sort of ending in that place, because many survivors will spend years ruminating. If I'd done this. And the clarity of your focus on Angelica, this is the daughter I wanted. This is the human being I wanted in the world. And a whole series of events had to happen, and that put Angelica in the world. And that framing of the suffering as something larger is that, you know, that whatever universal calculus is being done at that moment happened. And no, I didn't get out of the car. And by not getting out of the car, this happened. This human being came into my life. It's a hard way sometimes to view it because so much suffering happened. But it can sometimes be the way to view it that allows us to find the psychological strength, the soul strength, to keep fighting another day. So I have to say that perspective taking is quite remarkable given what you had went through. So thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you. Thank you for your work.
Here are my takeaways from my conversation with Joe. Let's start with one of the last things Joe said. Joe ended her story with a profound quote that I do hope at some point in their healing that survivors are able to feel. She said, to change anything is to change everything. I thought that was a beautiful framing. Now, I have no doubt that some survivors may not resonate with that, but for many of you, there was something that grew out of these toxic relationships. Beloved children, some good family relationships, self-awareness, and even experiences. I view it as those flowers that sometimes grow out of the sidewalk cracks. From the harshest of places, beautiful things can grow. We don't get do-overs, and all we can do is take a moment and recognize that there may be some things in our life that came from this struggle. Framing these experiences in a meaning-oriented way doesn't take away the pain, but it may foster your healing. In our next takeaway, when I hear a story like Joe's, I wish there was a high school class on warning signs and dangerous patterns in new relationships. The reactive sensitivity, fast driving, jealousy, these often are signs that show up early and are always a sign of problems to come. Charm and charisma can make it hard to spy these patterns. In Joe's relationship, she said she quickly slid into a pattern of rescuing, with Joe looking for places for him to live. And this rescuing can often happen if someone believes that this may soothe the narcissistic person. These patterns can start getting set early in narcissistic relationships, and somehow we have to find a way to shine a light on these patterns so there is less risk of young people making excuses for potentially abusive partners. For this next takeaway, this story teaches us how narcissistic tantrums and the drive to make them stop by appeasing the narcissistic person means that almost everything that happens in a relationship like this is coercive. Being paged multiple times on a cruise ship and then having to say yes to a marriage proposal so she could make his harassment stop is not consent. But yet over and over in these relationships, people relent to all kinds of things to make the abusive, harassing behavior stop for a moment. Then, when that gets coupled with a sense of guilt or pity for the narcissistic person, a person, especially a young person, can get corralled into a situation that is very difficult to safely climb out of. In our next takeaway, there's entitlement, and then there's entitlement. Her husband's request that she allow his girlfriend to move into their home together simply because she made him happy, that's a whole other level of entitlement. We always think we have gotten to the far boundary of entitlement, but then we hear something like this. It's easy to take a hard-line stance and believe we would never put up with something like this. However, after years of enduring emotional abuse in the relationship, a person in a relationship like this may not fully register it. However, Joe's body did register it, and the cardiac symptoms she was having turned out to be panic attacks, which are not unusual in people experiencing this toxic and abusive a relationship. In our last takeaway, Joe's pattern of self-blame after the plane crash went so deep that she blamed herself for the 9/11 attacks, which occurred just 17 days later. She was still in the throes of an acute stress crisis, and trauma survivors often do blame themselves for events that are clearly unrelated to them. But the similarity of the events, her accumulated history of trauma within the relationship, and the recent trauma of experiencing a similar event connects all of this. While most stories of post-separation abuse do not have such extreme outcomes, it is not unusual for survivors of these kinds of abusive relationships and post-separation abuse to blame themselves for a variety of incidents that happen in their lives for years to come.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.